Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
Yeah, good day, everyone.
Very understated, but warm. Yeah. It is the 5th of February, and it is episode 95. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We are going to be talking to friend slash foe slash hero slash villain of the podcast, all those things in one, Morgan Begg,
frenemy.
Yeah. Doesn't really capture the hero and villain, the hillin of the show. Morgan Begg, we're going to be talking to him. He's been the co-author of two reports that have come out this week. The IPA's Legal Rights Audit 2018, and also what's been affectionately known around the office as the Swamp Paper, which is going to be studying just how much the federal government is costing Australia every single year.
All his complaints that we interview him when he's busy.
Yep.
But that is why we want to interview him.
Yeah, it's a self-defeating prophecy right there. The busier he is, the more likely we're going to have him on the show.
It's just one of those things, Morgan.
Yeah. So, Pete, waiting till he's left.
Yeah,
the entire office, he's not even in today. To really unload the barbs, as all good journalists should. And we're also going to be talking to Gideon Rosner, who is going to be speaking at a really interesting event coming up with Warren Mundine and friend of the show, Jacinta Price. So we're going to be talking to Gideon about what that event's all about, where people can go to buy tickets. It's in the Northern Territory, which is a bit of a spoiler. And also Gideon's run-in with the Tower Fire, which has become a pretty big issue here in Melbourne, and he's been caught up in it. But we should probably go and talk about some of the big stories that have happened this week. And none so big as, and it's dragged out for a very long time, the Kerri-Ann Kennelly versus Yumi Steins on Studio 10's morning show. It happened on Wednesday last week, so we couldn't talk about it last week's show. We have to talk about it now, which is very rude of them to have a big story happen on a Wednesday when we can't really talk about it.
Big stories on a Wednesday.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. So pull your head in. Studio 10 would be my first thing. But anyway, if you haven't seen it, or if you sort of are half in, a half hour, basically what you need to know is Kerri-Ann Kennelly and Yumi Steins are in a Studio 10's show, and they're debating whether or not Australia Day should be moved. Now, Kerri-Ann Kennelly says, look, paraphrasing her point, she's saying this isn't the biggest issue in Indigenous affairs. If all the activists who want the date to be changed went out to communities and saw what was really happening, they would say, okay, maybe the date isn't the biggest issue in Indigenous affairs. She didn't execute the point that well. Like, it really got into a shouty match, and then Yumi Steins got into a shouty match, which left me flummoxed, because if we can't have a serious political debate on morning television, when can we have it?
Well, yeah.
Anyway, so Yumi Steins starts throwing out that Kerri-Ann Kennelly's a racist. That all becomes a row, and so on and so forth, and people can make up their own minds. Then this is what Pete and I really want to talk about, is that friend of the show, Jacinta Price, counsellor in Alice Springs, really awesome thinker. She wades into the debate. She is against a change to Australia Day, and she's on the Kerri-Ann Kennelly side of there are much bigger issues here at play. She weighs in, and then she cops a lot of online abuse. So she decides to just post it all to Facebook, like to show people what she's putting up with, just because she spoke out.
To shame her abusers.
Yeah. Now, if you were Facebook, you would go, this is cool. Okay, we have an online troll problem. Jacinta Price is exposing these trolls for who they are. And, you know, I'm not the biggest fan of doxing, but it's not like Jacinta Price was talking about where they lived and who their employers were. But it's just showing people that if they start trolling Jacinta Price, she will come back at them. But no, Facebook suspended her account for bullying.
Mm.
Your thoughts, Pete?
Well, I mean, that's crazy. There's heaps of people that do that all the time and they don't seem to get banned.
Yeah.
And I'd say that, you know, that we have a bit of a problem with, like, presumably what happens is she puts out those things, and then people complain about it, and, like, you know, the manager in charge of banning people in Facebook Australia just goes, oh my God, I don't know what to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to ban this person I've potentially never heard of.
Which is a really good knee-jerk reaction to have if you're in charge of banning people in Australia.
Yeah.
Is a lack of research and just knee-jerk reactions.
And it looks like, oh, you know, this is bad, so I'll ban her.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So Jacinta Price gets her account taken down for 24 hours, and then a few days later, it's just taken down again. And Facebook have said that was a mistake, which is a pretty big mistake. That is a guffaw. Like, you cop that much flack for taking it down once, and then you're just going to go like, oh, how about the second time?
Well, what happened with the second one was they said she made a comment that on a news story about the whole incident, which was the cause of her getting banned, but it was a mistake.
Mm.
And she claimed originally that it was because she put up these images of Australia Day protests and she replaced the banners with, you know, instead of change the date, she said, you know, protect the children or whatever.
Yeah.
But basically make a point.
I know. Like, you can't have that on Facebook.
And so that's what ended up getting her banned. But yeah. I mean, we've seen in the United States problems with the big tech giants, the big social media platforms being biased.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a bit of an issue because on the one hand, they're allowed to do whatever they want. But on the other hand, it's like they have huge power. And maybe we should start diversifying social media platforms, which is happening.
Or like the other way about it is if we want to have a mature discussion about changing the date and Indigenous affairs in Australia, just be prepared that Yumi Steins will call you a racist and then Facebook will take down your account. So you can take whatever side you want, but one, you're going to be told, great job. And the other one, Yumi Science is going to call you a racist.
Well, yeah.
So it's just, it's what you want. It is what you want. All right, cool. So we're going to be talking a little bit more with that with Gideon later in the
Correct,
show.
That's right.
But Pete, should we move on to another story?
We should. Okay, so let's. What I want to tell you guys about is a young author. Do you know what YA? I did. One of the great things about this story was that it taught me what YA stood for with regards to literature. Do you know what that was, Nana?
Young adult.
Okay.
What did you think it was, Pete?
I had to Google it, so I had no idea.
What else would it be?
Well, I don't know. I don't know.
Could you never read a book before?
Well, there's no need to get personal, Nina.
Spot
but no.
Ghost of the Park was an absolute triumph of the literary canon.
Anyway, so I worked out what that meant, and apparently a young author called Emily Wen Zhao, and I apologise if I pronounced that incorrectly, decided not to publish her book Blood Air after she got a shooing on Twitter for racial insensitivity. The book is sort of, and this is a quote from a piece I
got
read
a
about
what,
this.
Sorry?
A shooing.
What's a shooing?
Like a kicking. Like
so you don't know what YA is, but you know what the word shooing is.
I'm pretty old, James. Like, I'm a lot older than you. No, I don't know. Shooing, I don't know where I got that from. But it
bizarre turn James, this podcast is taking.
James is shaking his head. This book, apparently, according to Reason, is a sort of revisionist fantasy treatment of the legend surrounding Princess Anastasia of Russia, whatever that means. And it has copped a lot of abuse on Twitter. Some of the tweets I'll read. It is highly troubling that no one in the process of publishing or editing Blood Air saw a story about slavery, trafficking, and race relations and thought to bring in a sensitivity reader, or even several. One sensitivity reader is not enough, James.
Never.
And another one, my favourite, racist ass writers. We can say ass on the podcast.
Well, we just did.
Like Emily Wen Zhao, who literally take black narratives and force it into Russia when that beep never happened in history. You're going to be held accountable. Well, I don't think that person's take on history is that accurate.
Yeah.
I think we have seen versions of slavery in Russia. But anyway, so all these people had all these different problems with it and she decided not to publish it.
Yeah. If I were them, I would have just waited until the book was published and then just burnt the copies just to really show how progressive and open-minded they are.
Yeah. Well, you get that visual, don't you?
Yeah. You get the real visual of where about peace and love when you actually see the book embers flying into the air.
We're about diversity and inclusion.
Yeah.
Of course.
So there is two main stories about this whole thing. So you've got Jesse Signal and Tablet and Kat Rosenfield and Vulture, and they basically can't really find the problem with the book.
That's right.
And there's dozens, like, as Pete says, like, there's about depictions of slavery in Russia and all this stuff, but nothing to the point that if you're a publishing house, you would want to take it down because it was selling, pre-sales were quite good.
So you got a $500,000 advance.
I mean, that's a fair amount of money.
That's a lot of money.
I will also have $500,000 to not publish a book if that publishing house is looking to spend some money elsewhere. And then, like, there was also this accusation of plagiarism because she took literally one line from Lord of the Rings, which is the quote, "Go where I can't follow," which, you know, that's the tenet that holds up the entire Lord of the Rings trilogy.
Yeah.
So I can understand why you would want that taken down, being sarcastic, obviously. But, yeah, like, this is how open-minded people on the outrage mob are.
Yeah.
Like, this is almost literal book burning.
It's this weird thing you can't put, you know, one person can't take something out of one culture and put it in another culture and see, like, isn't that's used to be how we kind of explore different cultures, but seeing how different works in different contexts and things like that.
Yes.
So it's this weird thing. And it's kind of this, you know, you can't have, like, another book, other books have been criticised. A book called The Black Witch, for example, was said to be racist because it had evil characters doing racist things.
Right.
It's like, so you can't depict someone being racist in a book?
Yeah.
Even if you're saying it's bad?
Yes.
So, I don't know.
Yeah, wasn't there that case, like, a while ago of, like, an English author was investigated because one of their characters said something racist, and it was like, you know, yeah, the idea that like even your characters have to be the same bland NPC non-player characters that we are.
This is a fiction work.
Yeah. All right. Cool. So you can read more about that at Variety and Vulture.
But apparently that's a big feature of the YA genre.
Racism.
No, well, just these kind of
sorry, that was disputes. That was too easy.
These kind of disputes are a big...
It's a cutthroat industry.
The YA.
The YA, which stands for?
Young adult.
It's burned into his brain now. All right, cool. I'll move on to another story. So the Covington students. You did mine, so I'm just stealing one back.
I did do yours.
This is live producing.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, so Covington students. Now, a few weeks ago, you guys remember this. So we had the March for Life rally in Washington, D.C. A few students from the town of Covington were waiting for a bus. Nathan and they get into a standoff with the Black Hebrews of Israel, I think was the group. And then Nathan Phillips waded into everything. Big kerfuffle.
You might have seen it on the internet.
You might possibly have seen it on the internet. Well, absolute kerfuffle. And then, like, the media starts talking about how the boys are terrible and they hit that guy's face, gets blasted all around the internet.
They got a shooing.
Word of the day. Shooing and young adult, the two words of the day. Anyway, Covington students are now struck back. So, more than 50 media organizations, celebrities, and politicians have been sent letters. They haven't been sent lawyers, but they've been sent letters from lawyers. They'll need lawyers. But the Covington Catholic High School... from lawyers representing the Covington Catholic High School students seeing the controversial videos, 50 media organizations, among them Senator Elizabeth Warren, actors Alyssa Milano and Jim Carrey, media organizations CNN, New York Times, Washington Post, and even the Diocese of Covington. Like, these are all people that are going to need a lawyer up because the Covington students are coming.
Kathy Griffin. TMZ.
TMZ as well.
GQ. Did you say CNN?
I did say CNN, but this is all good stuff. So there is one debate, which is to what extent CNN complicit because they're commenting on a news story, and it definitely was a news story due to the amount of people calling about it, and to what extent can these people protect their identity. There's another argument to be had here, which is one I want to wade into, which is suck it.
That is a very nuanced, that is a highbrow legal argument.
That's the area I want to direct this conversation, which is... lining up all these people that saw 10 seconds of a video or maybe just one screenshot and decided to ruin this kid's life.
Yep.
Here we go.
Well.
Lawyer up.
Well, I'm of that argument as well. Like, I'm a big free speech guy, you know, but eat it.
Yep.
You guys, like, these are people who say they stand up for the most vulnerable people in society.
Yep.
And when they saw an opportunity to go after the most vulnerable people in society.
A 15-year-old kid.
Children. They took it, and these kids got death threats and all the rest of it. Not saying that those organisations did that or encouraged that, but, you know, all these terrible things happened and now they should be made to pay for their sins.
Yeah. I just like the idea of Jim Carrey sharing the defendant's box with CNN. Like, that's going to be a fun visual.
What's that movie though? He's a lawyer? Can't lie. Liar. Well, stop lying. You can't lie.
Some should have watched allegedly, his own movie. Should
obviously, the boys in Legal will take that out.
Oh, I might leave it in.
Yeah.
All right, cool. And let's talk the final story here, Pete, which is...
match fixing Australian sport.
Oh, hit me.
Okay, so obviously this is the biggest issue facing Australians at the moment.
And I'm glad the government has decided to weigh in.
You know, house prices, things we've been talking about all week in Indigenous communities. No, it's not that.
Mm-hmm.
It is match fixing in Australian sport and... the three things that this thing will... Hang on, let me start from the start. Okay, so the nature's...
Good place to start.
The nature's...
Actually, no. Could you start halfway through, then scratch, and then back to the start, and then we meet you again halfway through, and then there's a battle scene at the end.
Yeah. Well, I tried that, and it didn't work, so I'm just going to go from the start. The nation's top sporting codes, including the AFL and NRL, will be subject to a sweeping new anti-corruption regime overseen by a national watchdog to tackle match fixing and cheating. Cheating?
Mm.
What, so like West Coast... That should have been a free kick to Collingwood at the end of the grand final. This is what the government's getting involved in now.
Well, John Lloyd would be very happy with that if you listen to last week's
show. John Lloyd called for it last week and it's happened. So that, you know, when that man asks for something, it happens.
Yeah.
So the catalyst for the new body is an inquiry by former police corruption Royal Commissioner James Wood, who, along with, you know, state and federal police had concerns about corruption and organised crime infiltrating sport, blah, 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 blah. We'll begin operation in July 2020. We'll regulate sports wagering, monitoring and investigating of doping activity, and assisting sports to develop policies to ensure integrity.
Mm.
What is that?
Well, what it is just going to be securing the future of Australian sport. Like, the Australian government has now weighed in. So yeah. We're done.
Well, yeah. Like,
cower in fear, the Australian government is coming to fix sport.
If you think that, you know, you can hold your teammates, your opponent's jumper as when the ball's down the other end.
Yeah.
The Integrity Commission's coming for you. No,
I want a live arrest on field. Yeah, that's what I want to say.
It's crazy that this is a government, you know, area of concern.
Yeah, and it's coming right at the nick of time as well. I mean, they've come at, 5 months since the ball tampering scandal and 4 years since the Essendon drug scandal?
Yeah.
So the government really moving quickly on this one. They want to nip this in the bud before it becomes a big issue.
The wheel's just turning along nicely.
And what I like about this, so halfway through the article about this, understood the regime may lead to the National Anti-Doping Regulator, ASADA, being given increased powers to investigate doping. Now, if any AFL, and I think NRL fans are listening, if there's one organisation in Australia that definitely needs more power, because boy oh boy do they know how to use it, it is ASADA.
Oh,
they are clean, they are thorough, they get things done.
They get them done quickly.
They get it done quickly. They're in, they're out like ninjas in the night. Suddenly you just wake up and half the team's gone.
That's right. And of course, doping's illegal. Oh, no, that's right, it's not illegal. So interesting to see the government involved in it.
Oh, actually, can I... All right, we might have to cut this out because it's just too good an idea or I'm not allowed to say it. But okay, we did have to cut that.
Yeah, we had a little chat.
We had a chat off air, hopefully. Hopefully I remember to take all that out. And we decided to cut that.
Yep.
Now, where were we?
Well, I'd like to make a call.
Go.
I think that all this stuff that the government does, which we say they shouldn't,
mm-hmm.
It's fine if they do it. Let's just have what I'm going to call the tick box revolution.
Okay.
So you can tick whether you want to, when you get your tax form or whatever.
Yep.
There's no such thing as a tax form. But when you get whatever it is, right? Yeah. Everyone gets to tick the stuff they want to
pay. Your idea is falling down. It's halfway through your pitch, you admitted it doesn't exist.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I've got ideas, man. Yeah, I'm not, the minutiae.
Boys in corporate will figure it out.
Yeah, exactly. Hit me with a bait. Boys in corporate will figure it out. We should just have a little tick box and you can tick if you want your taxes to go towards this stuff. So if you want to fund sport or the Integrity Commission, you don't have to. If you don't want to fund public art, you don't have to. But if you do want to, you can.
And if you can, like, fund me, only want to fund the epidemic of crocodiles tearing people to pieces in far north Queensland, you can sign it with me and Bob Catter.
Yeah, exactly.
And we get things done.
If that's what you want, and I should have mentioned that when I said Australia was facing big issues before. I should have.
They're still out there, Pete. Cool. All right, so that's it for the main stories this week. Now, we'll now go to interviews with Gideon and Morgan. But before we do... just want to say, plug a few things the IPA is doing. So hopefully by now, all of our subscribers are also subscribed to the Looking Forward podcast, the IPA's new one with Scott Hargraves and Dr. Chris Berg. That's two episodes in, some really insightful, deep discussions on these things, which is good because Pete and I do not specialize in the deep discussions. We specialize in the fun discussions, but I wouldn't say deep.
Well,
would you say deep?
I thought I was being deep this whole time, but... Everyone, and now, I think that's
our
problem, laughing.
Our version of Dave.
Yeah, as Dave as I can be.
We're like the kid that's just learned how to swim, and he thinks like once he can't touch the bottom of the pool, he thinks he's in the deep end, and it's like, hang on, you need to look up because it's 2 meters deep
We are that kid.
And we are that kid. Make sure that comes out every Wednesday. Tomorrow they're going to be discussing the banking commission, so if you do want to know a bit more about that, you can go download that show. Available on all good podcast platforms, as is Young IPA Podcast. Now, over at ipa.org.au, we have two articles by Daniel Wilden last week. Does the Morrison government have the strength to slash red tape? Where Daniel Wilden discusses the fact that David Lionhelm is now departing the Australian Senate to run for New South Wales State Senate. And he wants to know who else is going to stand up to take on red tape in the Australian government, because the Senate Red Tape Committee did a lot of good stuff, and who's going to take on the challenge there. Mm-hmm. And also Daniel Wilde started covering the Labor tax plan on franking credits and how the people that are going to be really affected by that tend to be elderly women. So if you do want to read more about that, you can go to ipa.org.au. And thank you guys so much for listening to this podcast. Thank you so much for downloading and telling all your friends and family about it. Make sure that you're telling them that they can download it on any single podcast app for free, any of them, and they'll be able to listen to the show. And if you are listening out on iTunes, please leave us a 5-star rating. It really helps us out bringing the podcast to new people. And I should say, if you're also listening to Looking Forward on iTunes, make sure you're leaving that a 5-star review.
Any weird country? Not weird.
Weird countries?
Any countries that you might not expect us to be listened to this week?
Well, just like, you know, because they subscribe to the show, like they listen every week. But I should give like a running fun fact. We have this many downloads in this country.
That's what we should do.
But I don't know if our listeners are interested. I think this is you and me who like the idea that we're being broadcasted in Saudi Arabia.
The internet's a great thing.
Yeah. Cool. Now, Nina, if people support our work and they want to help out, where can people go if they want to become a member? And if they are already a member, where can they go if they want to donate?
Just visit the website, ipa.org.au. Click on the donate button if you like to donate, or if you like to become a member instead, just click on the join button, and starting as low as $22 per year, you become one of the loudest voices of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. Let's go to those interviews now.
Awesome.
Okay, we now welcome back onto the show, longtime friend and foe of the podcast. Been a while, but Morgan Begg, research fellow here at the IPA, welcome back.
Thank you, thank you.
Now, we are bringing you back in because you've had a pretty big week. We've had the release of two different reports, both with Morgan's, you know, name on the cover.
Yeah.
Yep.
And we wanted to...
My involvement.
Yeah. Your involvement.
My author.
Yeah. Under the name author. Yeah, that's important. And we want to talk to you about them. So I think we're going to start with the Swamp Paper. Now, this is something Pete and I talked about briefly on last week's show.
We did.
Do you want to tell us about what the Swamp Paper is?
So the Swamp Paper is an investigation or analysis of how the special interests in Canberra benefit from the circulation of taxpayer money. I suppose what it is, it's the sort of the amount on top of the size of government that is really only there to benefit the sort of people that are already in Canberra. So what this is involved is the premium on public sector wages or money that goes to non-government organisations to advocate for a bigger government.
Right. So it costs Australian taxpayers $8 billion a year.
This is a conservative estimate. We've only researched seven areas of taxpayer spending. That's a limitation because the swamp in reality is so pervasive. Our research is limited in scope.
Okay, so well done firstly on getting two reports done. That's the only way to break the Bella De Brera monopoly on the podcast. So well done.
She's fuming somewhere.
Well, yeah, she's not happy. So tell us, who are the biggest swamp creatures?
So it's the bureaucracy, I suppose, is simply put, the entirety of the public service, which collects approximately $5.5 billion a year, in the what we call the wage premium. So this is what a public servant earns above what a citizen in the private sector would earn.
Okay, so it's like average earnings for
So that's our largest calculation was that premium. And then of course the other big one is the public broadcasters.
Okay,
because this is of course we know that organisations like the ABC do have an institutional bias. They act just like a bureaucracy does in any other part of the government, and that collects $1.3 billion approximately each year. Oh, well, that and the SBS.
Could you just hit us with the most egregious example of swampery that you came across in the report?
Well, one of the more perverted forms of swampery, as you call it, which is really also a perversion of the Australian democratic process, is the amount of funding which goes towards organisations which promote constitutional change.
Okay, thought that might be the case.
Yeah, so in many ways, the process of how referendums and constitutional change debate is promoted is the height of elitism. A lot of the push for change is actually generated from the top to convince us to accept the change that they want.
Mm.
And of course the example that was highlighted in our research paper, because it focused on 2016-17, was constitutional recognition.
Yep. So here's this national discussion that's really important that we have, and we're going to give a whole lot of money to the side we want to get up.
Exactly right. That's right. So reconciliation.
So Australia. That's democracy,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, that's as we know it. Yeah.
So how this actually occurs in practice, though, is often a bit sneaky. So it's not necessarily we're just going to give money directly. It's kind of government-funded organisations then lobby. I don't know what I'm saying.
Well,
did any of that make sense?
I can run with it.
Yeah, yeah, he's a professional.
Yeah, yeah. So often there are direct payments, and there's, you know, a wide array of opaque grant programs, and there's umbrella organizations which receive funding, and then the members of that umbrella organization also receive funding. There's there's a wide array of different forms of how these payments are made, and one of the more interesting ones was the Diversity Council of Australia.
Okay.
Where the Diversity Council of Australia does say technically correctly that they don't receive government funding, but then you look through the members of the Diversity Council, and about a quarter of them are government departments.
And they pay fees too.
Yeah, and they pay the fees. So there's a lot of sort of opaque ways that it happens, and back doors. And
that is the exact type of thing I was looking for with my half question.
Yeah, we got there. We didn't start great, but we got there in the end. So that's like, oh no, you go.
Sorry for asking so many questions in a row, but I'm really interested in this.
As long as you
get
your full question out, I'm going to be happy.
I will. Believe in you. So no one else has done this kind of work before in Australia, have they?
No. No, no.
And so that's why it's really
important. There's very little. That's right.
It's not technically a question, but continue.
So that was, you know, one of the challenges in the developing a methodology was that it was entirely original. There's very little a precedent for us to work from. Mm-hmm. This was me and Daniel Wild, of course, or even overseas to get it.
Really?
That's right. So, very original research. Right here. Yeah.
So you're saying Trump didn't measure up all the facts and figures and numbers before he invented the word swamp?
Oh, well, as it happens, the most recent iteration of swamp. That's right. So talk about draining the swamp has actually existed on and off for about a century.
Is that right?
Yeah. So, and in fact, it was about 100 years ago when people were talking about draining the swamp, it was used by socialists to drain the capitalists.
Is that right?
Yeah, man. Yeah. But it was actually Ronald Reagan, actually, in 1982, I think, who said that to an assortment of his senior advisors and cabinet officials and whatnot, who talked about draining the swamp of larger government and high taxes.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Well, yeah. A bit of a history lesson. Yeah. All right, so it's obviously been an issue for a while then, if it's been used for over a century. So how did it get so bad in Australia? Like, this $8 billion dollar expenditure didn't pop up overnight, and people are just like, what's that giant swamp doing? So, like, it's incremental. So how does it get bad?
Yeah, absolutely. So another way to think of the swamp is also the development of the regulatory state and corporatism, which really took off in the 1980s under the Hawke government. So what you had prior to then was a strict delineation in the economy between the sort of less regulated market sector, and on the other side you had industries which were government controlled and regulated. And the period of deregulation, which did bring many benefits, actually saw a lot of that government regulation spread over the entire economy. And that's where a lot of the sort of special interests have really sort of flourished in Canberra, out of that regulatory regimes.
And how do we get things back to manageable?
This paper that Daniel and I have done highlights just some of the problem areas where this has exploded. So there's a blueprint for reform right there. But more broadly, it's your classic sort of cut red tape agenda. You have to withdraw Canberra from many of its regulatory functions and defer or relegate to the states where appropriate. And just in general, we sort of draw back power from the bureaucracy, sort of eliminate the need for all these self-interest groups to sort of agglomerate in Canberra.
Now, Morgan, last question on this paper. We'll move on to another one, but I do want to say you are not a huge fan of the swamp. Drain the swamp, one of Morgan's more said phrases around walking around the IPA.
Yeah.
Is this your favourite report you've ever worked on, the true labour of love?
I think it is. I think it is actually. Yeah. It's just the way it started was just it was just meant to be a sort of collection of a few figures, but then it actually turned into a real sort of enjoyable analysis. Yeah, as much as a man can enjoy.
Policy analysis. Yeah. All right, cool. So we'll move on. So the other big report that you had out this week was the legal rights audit 2018.
Yes.
Now, this is a really important thing that Morgan does every year, and we've been doing before Morgan as well, talking about all the breaches of fundamental legal rights that exist in federal law in Australia. So do you want to run us through a few of the findings from this year's report?
Yeah, sure. So just as a bit of backstory, the legal rights audits begun at the end of 2014, where we found 262 breaches of fundamental, explicit breaches of fundamental legal rights being the presumption of innocence, natural justice, the right to silence, and the privilege against self-incrimination. And we've updated that every year, unfortunately, finding an increase in every single year, to the point where we're now at 358. It was quite a sharp increase this year.
We'll get into the sharp increase this year, but I just wanted to like step back and talk about like what do we talk about when we say these fundamental legal rights? Like this might be an obvious question, but like why are these four things so important in once we set up a legal system?
Yeah, well, these rights are really fundamental to achieving to a legal system being able to achieve just outcomes. Too often now, it's related to what we were talking about with the swamp. You know, there's a lot of deference given to sort of regulatory agencies or other prosecuting bodies within the government to essentially give them these broad, sweeping powers of investigation or questioning or and other related issues to essentially make the process of obtaining prosecutions or applying penalties easier, or to make challenges to those decisions more difficult. But what has to be realised is that it's actually the business of government, the business of these agencies is not to be more efficient or to be easier. It's better if prosecutions are more difficult, because you know we're talking about people's freedoms. We're talking about people's liberties, the ability to engage in their life and their business. Freely.
It shouldn't be the responsibility of the defendant to prove that they're innocent.
Exactly right.
Prosecution appeal. Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah.
So 34 new ones this year, 358 in total, is that right?
That's right.
It's important for listeners out there to note that this was zero not that long ago, is that right?
Once upon a time it was.
what kind of era are we talking?
When it was zero?
Yeah, so just because I just remember the graph from yesterday in Hay.
I was thinking like Stone Age, but yeah.
Yeah.
The presumption of innocence didn't exist then.
1901,
yeah.
No, the number was likely very, very low until the 1960s, 70s, I would say. A lot of these provisions, at least the ones that are still present in the law, really have only existed since the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So who are we talking about when we say like these, like when we say that people are getting affected by these, the removal of these fundamental legal rights, like are there specific types of people that keep popping up as being the victims of these things?
A lot of the focus of these laws affect people in areas of trade and commerce and tax and financial services, insurance, a lot of these areas which receive probably an ever increasing amount of regulatory oversight and intervention are more frequently having these sorts of legal rights breaches included.
Right. And as Pete pointed out, like there wasn't so long ago that there were very, very few breaches, and now we're up to 358. And if people saw the graph, which was on the IPA's Facebook page last night and our Instagram page and also in our Hey, What Did I Miss email, there seems to be a huge uptick in just like the last 10 years. Even. What's driving all that?
Well, it partly... In large part, of course, it's just the fact that the government is passing so many more laws each year. Where once upon a time, 5 decades ago, maybe it was, the federal government would pass, a few hundred pages of legislation each year. We're now getting into the, 5,000, 6,000 pages of legislation each year, which has been the common trend in the past 10 years.
All right.
And of course, a small part of that is, there's a process of sort of legislative renewal where old laws are repealed and new laws are introduced. But even in that process, you have old laws which don't have legal rights breaches replaced with new laws which do have legal rights breaches. So,
and do either side of politics have a particular tendency to try and stop legal rights breaches, or are they both as bad as each other?
I'd say that there's a very minimal difference between the parties.
In general. Like specifically on legal rights, but in general.
Yeah. Yeah, I won't disagree.
Yeah.
That's right. So the, both parties, both sides of politics are as committed to introducing, thousands and thousands of pages of new laws with legal rights breaches.
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. So that is the Legal Rights Order 2018. You can go to ipa.org.au if you want to read about that and read more about the fundamental breaches. You can also read the coverage that the Swan Paper got in The Australian on page 2. That's got featured on our Facebook page. So a bunch of ways you can go read more about this work. Now, Morgan, slice of life stuff now. So you have recently turned your back on the big city hustle and bustle.
Yeah.
And you've moved back to... Where?
Bendigo.
I thought it was Ballarat, but then Pete said it was Bendigo, and then I got confused. My brain started hot wiring. But Bendigo.
Doesn't pay attention.
No, not a huge personal interaction guy. Anyway, what has brought about the change, and what have you noticed about differences between Melbourne and Bendigo?
Tree change, they call it.
That's not bad.
It's like a sea change.
Yeah,
to the bush.
Okay.
So what in the bush, there's lots of trees.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Okay. Maybe explain it to me after the broadcast.
Few trees in the sea. Anyway, Morgs.
I was born and raised in Bendigo, of course. So it's a bit of a return home for me. Good to be able to see.
Triumphant return.
Yeah, triumphant return. I've conquered Melbourne, and now I'm heading back.
Like a Roman conqueror just leading the army through the streets.
Conquered Melbourne.
That's it. Of course, one of the big motivating factors, though, was just house prices. So managed to get a nice house up in Bendigo.
I've seen just plans. Dealing, it's very,
yeah.
I saw the outlook.
Yep. So just dealing with the commute now, which is...
Yeah, that's pretty brutal. So what have you noticed about, now that you're not in the hustle and bustle? Because you were living in...
last in Boronia, which is...
Yeah.
But also West Brunswick for a while.
West Brunswick. Yeah. Sorry for our...
Very close to Pete, but I never visited.
Yeah, we never...
Yeah, I'm also close to Pete. We've never visited. But anyway, so for our non-Melbourne listeners, Brunswick is a very, very left-wing kind of suburb. Very young, very left-wing. How have you found being out of that now?
One of the things that... I think this is probably common across most Melbourne suburbs is just... There's no sense of neighbourhood or community. There's no, you don't go and, go next door and meet people or.
Oh, no, no.
As soon as we went up to our new house, it's, we sort of, you go do the rounds with the neighbours and they all come around and I find that just a lot more pleasant.
Mm.
Yeah. I mean, that's not a very political point, but
that's right.
You'll be able to pull one out in the next 10 minutes. Yeah. You'll send me a follow-up email. It's just like, well, the real point about that.
So what are you going to be doing up there on the weekends? Are you going to play footy for Eagle Hawk or Stonyhurst or YCW?
Pete could do this for another 25 minutes.
Let's talk country footy for 5 hours.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's the next IPA podcast. Yeah. I think. I will play for Eagle Hawk in the cricket. That's the goal.
Really?
But not a footy player. Never been much of a footy player. So probably get into the basketball.
Oh
yeah.
Now we're talking my language.
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Well, we'll look forward to the invite up to the new homestead,
the one that you offered so bountifully to yours. But anyway, Morgan, thank you so much. IPA.org.au for all of Morgan's great work that he does here at the IPA. And make sure you're checking out our Facebook page for all the work on the Swan Paper. Morgan, thanks so much, man.
Thank you.
Thanks, Morgan.
Okay, we now welcome back to the show IPA Policy Director Gideon Rosner. Welcome back.
Great to be here.
Now, Gideon, you are going to be speaking at a very exciting event coming up with Warren Mundine and friend of the show, Jacinta Price. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so this was a surprising invite from a member of the IPA, actually, who put me in touch with the CLP up in Darwin. She's a former Territorian herself, and they were looking for a speaker for this function on identity politics. And as you said, it's with Warren Mundine, who's former Labor Party Indigenous leader and now Liberal Party candidate for the seat of Gilmore at the upcoming election, and Jacinta Price, who again is also an Indigenous leader, very, very prominent in the media, and is the candidate for the seat of Lingiari in the Northern Territory at the election. So it's a bit strange because, here am I, this white fella from Melbourne with two, great Indigenous leaders. I haven't done a lot of work on Indigenous policy before, but, one thing we do deal with a lot here at the IPA is about identity politics. Now, for the benefit of your listeners, if you haven't heard about identity politics already, I've gotten a working definition from our very own Dr. Bella de Brera, who said, "Identity politics defines individuals by their collective identity, either class, race, or gender. It's divisive because it means we are distinguished by our differences rather than our similarities. And the political consequence of that is instead of treating people all equally, we treat all people unequally." So where that ties into Indigenous affairs is we spend a lot of time in this country talking about Indigenous affairs through the lens of effectively identity politics-driven symbolism. We talk about things like changing the date. We talk about things like the Indigenous voice to Parliament. We talk about writing race into our constitution rather than taking it out. Now, look, I disagree on all of those issues. I don't think we should change the date. Obviously, I think race has no place in our constitution. I don't love the idea of a third chamber of parliament just for a specific, people of a certain ethnicity in Australia, even if they are our first Australians. But I can understand the debates. I can engage in those debates. What has been really, really disappointing lately is the treatment of people who have actually talked about more tangible problems in Indigenous communities: welfare dependency, sexual abuse, joblessness, utter human despair, which frankly is a national shame, the fact that we have our first Australians, our Australian brothers and sisters, living in third world conditions in a first world country. And that came to a boiling point, as you know, recently on the Studio 10 with Kerri-Ann Kennelly, who raised these issues saying, look, let's not talk about changing the date. Let's talk a little bit about these issues. She was jumped on by Yumi Steins, who's not an Indigenous person, but nevertheless felt it necessary to call her a racist for raising these issues. It beggars belief that the same people who purport to care so much about Indigenous people refuse to talk about what is happening in our own backyard in those communities. But this is where Jacinta Price and Warren Mundine come in, because these are two leaders who have been very, very passionate about their communities, who have seen, lived and breathed what has gone on, are passionate about helping their fellow first Australians, improve their lot in life and improve their communities, and frankly enjoy the benefits of a good, healthy, strong society that we enjoy as Australians. For that, they have been turned on by the left in the most disgusting of ways. And I really hesitate to repeat these slurs, but I think it's important for your listeners. Jacinta Price and Warren Mundine have been called names like coconut, that is black on the outside, white on the inside. A particularly offensive term, which again, I don't like to use, but I think it's important, is Uncle Tom, which was levelled at Warren Mundine, I believe, by somebody at the ABC or on an ABC program.
Is that right?
No censure has been made of that person. And the word Uncle Tom, it has to be, has extremely racist connotations from segregation in the US. It basically means a black person is sold out to their white slave owners, but literally translates into a house N-word. So for Warren Mundine, an Indigenous person, to be called that just because he disagrees with the orthodoxy of the left shows how deeply identity politics is embedded. It's so tribal. You're either with us or against us. And if you're against us, we'll turn on you. These are the same people who fly off the handle when you use the wrong pronoun, yet they are perfectly happy to level abuse at people like Warren Mundine and Jacinta Price. So it should be a really interesting discussion, and we'll see, what I can add from, an outsider's perspective, talking about identity politics, I guess more broadly.
Yeah, we talked about this earlier in the show, but when you say that Warren Mundine has been called an Uncle Tom, that's not just a one-off. He retweets every time he gets called that on Twitter, and it is a very high amount of times. And Jacinta Price, the week she she's had of all those online trolls coming at her for what she said on Studio 10. I mean, it is just incredible the outrage that they get.
Well, I was asked about this on the air. I did an interview on Sky a little while ago, and this was a story about when Jacinta Price, she's actually shamed people who've sent her the most, and this I won't repeat, the most disgusting abuse that she's received in her private messages on Facebook. She screenshotted them and shamed these people, quite rightly. Facebook banned her on the basis of bullying for that, right? So, you know, for Jacinta Price to cop all this outrage is one thing. For Facebook to then blackball her, you know, Facebook has a lot to answer for. They banned her twice now.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's I don't know how they get up in the morning and deal what they have done with, but, you know, the right principles and the right causes on their side.
Just before we move on, give us all the details of this event so that people can sign on if they want to head along.
So this event will be on the 22nd of February in Darwin. It'll be at the Frontier Hotel, and it's being organised by the Country Liberal Party. But members and subscribers, I think you guys are going to put it out in, hey, what did I miss this week, the details. So check it there. It's also available on Facebook, or get in touch with me directly at grosner@ipa.org.au. So any Territorians or fellow travellers who want to fly in, come along. It's going to be a great night.
Now, yeah. We've got a lot of fantastic members up in the NT, so it should be great.
And that's an awesome panel of speakers right there. So really head along and check it out. Now, Gideon, you've had an interesting week elsewhere.
He's always having pretty interesting weeks, Gideon.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm like Forrest Gump. I always get myself into these sticky situations.
Exactly. But have you ever, like, run away from a president? But anyway.
Not yet.
In Melbourne, there's now a tower evacuation, which you've been caught up in. So what has the last few days been for you like?
So as you've probably read in the media, there's been sort of the towering inferno in Spencer Street. The 200 Spencer Street building has been caught a lot, partly because of cladding, partly because presumably of overcrowding and all sorts of other things. And that's where I've lived actually since 2011. So, and the funny thing is I actually slept through the entire fire. Like, by the time I woke up and realised what was happening, I would have slept through entirely if I hadn't been up getting a cup of water at, you know, 6 a.m. and a neighbour had been pounding on my door. I thought I was being robbed or something. This neighbour said, there's a fire. And I looked out the window and it was just this sort of plume of smoke. I thought, oh, well, it's a kitchen fire or something. Apparently the whole building had been in flames for hours. There were about 12 fire trucks there, camera crews galore and everything else. So I put on my hoodie and jeans and skedaddled down the fire escape and came to work in my jammies. So
you didn't really get the sixth sense that there was a camera crew nearby and wanted to run towards it?
Oh, like, well, I went out. Actually, I'm shameless, but I'm not that shameless when it comes to getting in front of a camera. But I actually walked out in my hoodie and everything else, looking like, you know, death warmed up. And I said to the media scrum, I said, does anybody want a doorstop? And they all sort of turned towards me and lunged. And I said, oh, only joking. And they grunted and turned away. So I've ticked off our friends in the Fourth Estate. But, yeah, so I'm still homeless. I haven't been let into my building. I'm still have the clothes off my back. So, yeah, I got to say, it's a hard living in Spencer Street. You got to pray for Rosner.
If you do want to, you know, put Gideon up for a few days, write in.
Yeah.
He's a great house guest.
I wouldn't go that far.
Full of entertainment.
Yeah, oh, it's never a dull moment.
So what time in the morning was it? It was 6 in the morning.
So the fire started about 5 a.m. I got wind of it at 6 when the fire department, to their credit, acted very swiftly and got it on. Because it spread to 6 stories or something.
Yeah. And did you think, with someone knocking on the door, do you think the authorities have finally caught up with
you? Yeah, I'm like, oh, well, what took them so long?
I had a good run.
Yeah, it's been a good 32 years, but, you know,
has to be paid.
My time has come.
All right, cool. Gideon, thanks so much for joining us. Make sure you're heading along to that event. Going to be an absolutely great day, and hopefully you're back in your building soon enough.
Fingers crossed.
Fantastic.
Okay, thank you to Morgan Begg and Gideon Rosner for those interviews. Make sure you're heading down to that Gideon Rosner event. It is going to be a cracker. Now, let us run through some stories that have made us laugh this week.
Yep.
This is my favorite apology I've ever read.
Yep.
I've read some pretty good apologies out there. This is the best.
Yep.
Sorry. Governor Ralph Northam, the Democratic governor of Virginia, he is in a bit of hot water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a photo from his yearbook has come out. And in this photo in a yearbook is, it's like he's in the caption, and it's a photo of two men. One of them is in blackface and the other one is in a Klan outfit.
Ooh.
Now, why this
not
is
a great
in,
combo.
No, yeah. So one, don't ever be in that photo. And two, why is this in a yearbook? People are just like, oh, it's a yearbook photo of this. Like, how did that get in the yearbook? Yeah.
I wonder what the second best photo was.
Yeah.
The stuff that didn't make it.
Yeah. What was on the cutting room floor? Now, Northam immediately apologized for the image, and people are calling for him to resign. And he waited a day and then he said, actually, that's not me in the image. I'm not either of those two people. Because he couldn't remember which one he was, which is a concerning sign. But he said, actually,
could have been either.
Yeah, actually, neither of them are me. But I did go in blackface when I was a Michael Jackson impersonator at a dance contest.
Yeah, different time.
Now,
so
the key to any apology, as I understand them, is to not admit further guilt.
Yeah. Well, sometimes it's good to get caught in it.
No, I'm not blackface in that photo.
Yeah.
This other one, you guys got to be worried about.
Sometimes it's good to get it all at the table, you know?
Yeah. So that is just an incredible apology.
That's right.
I mean, like, there's, again, serious points to be made here, like with the serious points we had earlier in the show of, like, to what extent can, like, 30-year-old photos bring down people's careers? Mm. That's a pretty bad one, and you're definitely going to hurt your own re-election chances for sure.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just take this for what it is, which is the single worst apology I've ever heard.
Well, James, I'm surprised that you missed another element of this apology, which added to its greatness.
Go.
And I'm going to just read out of the news report here. Later in the press conference, Mr. Northam appeared to look around for a space on stage after a reporter asked if he was still able to moonwalk Jackson's signature dance. His wife, Pam Northam, was heard saying, inappropriate circumstances, before Mr. Northam said, my wife says inappropriate circumstances.
100% he can still moonwalk.
Oh, yeah. He was like, he was like, oh, show these guys.
That is...
Imagine doing that.
He would have.
Yeah.
He was looking for a space.
So, like, so this really serious thing where, you know, you're trying to regain the credibility of the people. I'm going to moonwalk.
No, but like...
Imagine if he had done that. I wish his wife wasn't there. It would have been amazing.
That, it would have been amazing. But what this is someone that is so proud of themselves for being able to moonwalk that at no point in any... particular, like, he could have been at a funeral and just as the coffin's been taken away, someone just leans in and goes, you can still moonwalk, right?
Yeah.
He would be like, yeah, check it out, man. And he would have moonwalked down the aisle.
And he's
he would have done it. He would do it anywhere.
Well, my career's great, but everyone knowing I can still moonwalk.
Yeah, look, I'm going down. Might as well moonwalk out of it.
But he's not resigned. He's just saying, no, I'm going to stay.
Yeah, give it a few more days, I reckon. He'll be out of there.
James, all
right, let's move on.
Let's move on. Yep, that's right. So we've talked about onerous restrictions on smoking.
Yes.
Smoking in restaurants, sin taxes, all that sort of thing.
Smoking slightly near food.
That's right, yep. Yeah. Smoking in the same city block as food. Hawaii is taking a step further. They're going to ban smoking to the age, if you're under the age of 100.
Mm.
How funny is that? We're not going to ban it. We're just going to ban it for people under the age of 100. Cigarette is considered the deadliest artifact in human history, says this legislator in Hawaii. Killed 100 million people in the 20th century and he's likely to kill 1 billion people in the 21st century.
Yeah, I like that. I think the nuclear weapon might have something to say about what's the most deadly object in human history.
Well, that's true. I mean, it probably hasn't killed as many people as cigarettes, but there you go.
Well, there's been only been two.
Yeah, well, anyway. So they're going to raise the legal age to 30 by 2020, 60 by 2023, and 100 in 2024. And retailers who sell cigarettes to underage Medicare recipients will be subject to fines of $100. Sorry, $500 per violation.
I like this as a way of encouraging people to respect the elderly because what you're doing now is making them the most prized people for Hawaiian smokers because who else is going to buy the cigarettes? You just get your 101-year-old Nana and you say, Nana, need you to go in that store. Mm-hmm. Need you to get me some cigarettes.
And she goes...
This is social cohesion at its finest. People are visiting elderly relatives. They're going to have young people volunteering at nursing homes trying to get cigarettes from them. This is how you promote societal well-being.
That is a very... This is, it's about time, because we are a youth-worshipping society.
Yep.
It's about time we turn the tables.
Yeah, I think this is the end game here. I don't think this is a smoking measure. I think this is a pro-aging measure.
Well.
The other thing is.
What's this fella's name? I can't find
Oldie McGoldison.
Richard Cregan.
Richard Cregan. The other part of it is, I like e-cigarettes and vaping. That's all fine. Mm-hmm. So Hawaii just became the vape capital of the world.
It's true.
Yeah. So vape on, my Hawaiian friends. Anyway, Pete, did you have any takes on this story?
No, that was it.
All right, cool. I've got one. So yesterday. That's how forgettable this Super Bowl was. But it's a big day for me. I always love the Super Bowl. This one, very disappointing one. We can get into that. Probably not. But what I will get into is that the Super Bowl was in the city of Atlanta. Now, Atlanta wanted to, as governments often do, they wanted to really make sure their city was looking nice and crisp for the Super Bowl. A lot
spiffy.
Of people, a lot of journalists are going to be there. A lot of photographers are going to be there.
Mate, have you ever been to a city and go, "Oh, gee, that was a crisp city"?
Have I ever looked at someone get yelled at and said, "Man, that's a shoeing"?
Mate, people say shoeing.
People say crisp. All right, agree to disagree. We'll fight off air.
I agree that I'm right.
This is a better contest than the Super Bowl was yesterday. Anyway, so Atlanta, to make sure their city did look crisp, they wanted to build a new bridge from the Mercedes-Benz Stadium, where the stadium was going, where the Super Bowl was, to the nearest Vine City public transit station. So just get the people off the transit system, get them to the stadium.
Mm-hmm.
The cost was going to be $13 million, and then they decided to up it to $23 million just to make sure it got ready for the Super Bowl, which would have worked if it was indeed ready for the Super Bowl,
mm-hmm.
because the signs went up that you cannot use this on Super Bowl day. So they spent $23 million on a bridge to literally nowhere.
That's right.
Yeah, you can't use that bridge.
The reason that they didn't wasn't ready for Super Bowl was because it was a security risk.
Mm.
Security risk.
Yep. Yeah.
They had to put up their security breaches around thingos around the stadium, and because this bridge kind of just went straight into the stadium,
yeah.
Which I guess is to its credit.
Which is what you wanted.
They couldn't use it.
Yeah, I'm glad that no one thought of that in any of the meetings. Like yeah. $23 million that could have been spent elsewhere.
Well, what happens?
Or just like given back to the taxpayers.
Yeah.
Instead went to a bridge.
What happens next time? Like, isn't it always a security breach?
Yeah.
Is it not a security breach just during a normal game?
No, they'll build an even bigger bridge. But that and one that leads into the security thing.
Hmm.
And then this bridge is just there as a monument.
And it's,
imagine paying $23 million to see your to let everyone know that your government can't build a bridge.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money. Because everyone's still walking by the bridge. Like, it's yeah. right near the stadium.
Oh, they have to walk, like, under it.
Yeah, yeah. They're like, that is the thing that I wish I could be using right now.
So,
$23 million.
So no one can use it.
No one can use it.
Like,
it'll be ready eventually, but they can't be ready for the Super Bowl day, which they did spend an extra $10 million making sure it would be ready for.
Wow.
Yeah.
And, but it should be noted, spectators were able to use it on their way out.
Oh, that's good.
So, you know, 50%, yeah. glass half full. I think that's all I had for that. Oh, no, I didn't. This reminds me of when I went to the World Cup in 2014 in Brazil. Yep.
Oh.
Stadium was finished.
You were at the World Cup in 2014 in Brazil.
Correct.
Oh, never mentioned it.
Is that being smart? Yeah. The stadium, it was a real rush to get the stadiums finished. Got into this stadium. I forget what city it was in. Beautiful stadium. Everything was done, except in the bathrooms, the toilet paper was just sitting on the ground because they hadn't had time to put in the toilet paper holder.
Oh, that's not hygienic.
One more thing.
Oh,
the last thing.
There's always a lot.
Literally put your tools down. Game starts in 10 minutes. Out you get. Just put it on the ground. Put it on the ground. There you go. Bit of, you know,
yeah.
Slice of life for you. Okay, now that we've done toilet paper.
Actually, while I'm on the Super Bowl,
okay.
I just do this one thing.
Oh, do you want to talk about the Super Bowl?
Yeah. I just want to, like, no one cares what I think about the Super Bowl. I don't care what I think about the Super Bowl. Anyway, Brian Krasenstein. Here's something I do care about. Brian Krasenstein, people might know him as basically a professional Trump troll. He's one of the people that was among the plaintiffs when the court decided that Trump can't block people on Twitter. And it was like Dr. Eugene Guru, Brian, Ed Krasenstein, and a few others.
I was going to ask where this guy came from.
Yeah, so Trump had to follow them. That's his claim to fame, and he now just responds to every Trump tweet ever. Okay. And then basically that.
So anyway, he's just creating jobs, Trump. That's a good
thing. Yeah, is this a job? But anyway, Brian Krasenstein had a Super Bowl-related tweet, as many people did. While many of you are likely yelling, "Go Patriots" or "Go Rams," I'm yelling, "Go Robert Mueller and the rule of law."
Okay. Thank you.
It's just sad. How sad do you have to be to tweet that?
It's not going to be a fun guy at parties.
No.
And like they don't, I mean,
imagine
do they
yelling that out at a stadium.
Yeah.
One guy in the back.
Yeah.
Robert Mueller and the rule of law.
Ooh. Yeah. No, I mean, and like, it's ironic because obviously they don't care that much about the rule of law.
No.
So that's interesting. Did that get ratioed, as they say in the game?
Not as much as you'd think, because it kind of, like, you know, any tweet is basically a drop in a bucket. But he did get 5,500 replies, 3,000 retweets, and 20,000 likes
is
as
that
of
ratio?
This morning. Ratioed, a proper ratioing is more replies than favourites. That's the golden ratio.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
I want to say, James, I want to ask you a question about the Super Bowl. What do you think of Maroon 5? Because that's
my
talking point.
My expectations were so low
yep.
that they kind of met it.
Yep.
So, like, I wasn't actually that disappointed. And that they only really played songs off that first Maroon 5 album, which I will go to my dying breath saying was an absolute banger of an album. Like, that was a good album. Songs About Jane.
I only know their most famous song and I like it.
The She Will Be Loved one?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Nana's first album. Nodding. Or she was nodding.
But I'm always going to say, if you're going to have a Super Bowl in Atlanta, it's got to be dirty South rap music.
Okay.
You need a homage to the city. You needed Outcast reunion. You needed Travis Scott. You needed Run the Jewels or, you know, Killer Mike. You needed that Missy Elliott, that kind of thing. You can't have Maroon 5 from California coming in.
And did you, sad. What did you think about him taking his shirt off?
Look, if I looked like that, I'd be shirtless right now.
Okay. Well,
thank God you're not.
Well, speaking of tweets on Twitter that are silly. It's a real niche.
Seamless transition.
It's a real niche category.
Wow.
Tweets on Twitter that are silly. It's a new segment. And we've got two of them today.
We're the only podcast that would do it.
Yeah. Who else talks about Twitter and how stupid it is? Okay. Father Rod Boer of the Gosford Anglican Church in Australia.
Very famous church.
So he said, he had a bit of a tweet today on the 4th of February 2019, which didn't get ratioed based on that thing you just told me. And it said, hashtag kids off Nauru is great, but sending them to hashtag USA commits them to a life of potential hardship in what is essentially a feudal system where a wealthy elite rules over a vast and impoverished population. The hashtag American dream is now a nightmare for so many. Hashtag Auspol.
That's an amazing take.
That's a hell of a take.
Kids on Nauru, that is an amazing take.
Yeah.
They're better off there than in America.
Back there, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Like, that's a lesson out there for people that want to become active in the political sphere.
Mm.
That's a level of take you need to have.
Yep.
That's a level of out there opinion of just nonsensical babble that you need to provide. You need to bring that to the table.
Feudal system.
For anyone to take you, I give you credit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Feudal system.
Take notes.
Impoverished population. Anyway,
all right,
check
cool.
it out.
That is it for the show this week. Thank you very much to Gideon Rosner and Morgan Begg for those interviews. And make sure you're getting along to Gideon Rosner's event. Make sure you're downloading and subscribing to the new podcast from the IPA's Podcast Network, Looking Forward Podcast with Dr. Chris Berg and Scott Hargraves. We've also got a very special episode of the Looking Forward Podcast coming out in the next few days with Andrew Roberts talking about his new biography on Churchill, and John Roskam, the executive director here at the IPA, is going to be sitting in on that interview. Really, really interesting chat. I produced it this morning. And if you are interested in Churchill and if you are interested in his effect on the political world, you can't miss this chat. Like, Andrew Roberts' biography has been called the single best biography of Winston Churchill ever written.
That's right.
Yeah, and cool. And thank you guys so much for listening to this podcast. Thank you so much for downloading and subscribing. Make sure you're telling your friends, family, people you know who would like the podcast about the show. We're available on any good podcast platform that is out there. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us a 5-star review. Now, Nina, if people like this podcast, if they like the work that we're doing and they want to support by becoming a member of the podcast, you cannot become a member of this podcast.
No.
It is a 3-person show and that's the way we likes it. But you can become a member of the IPA and you can donate to the IPA. How can people do that?
Well, just visit the websites and click on the donate button if you like to donate, or if you want to become a member of the IPA, just click on that join button, and starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Cool. See you guys next week.
See you later.